Good afternoon. My name is Jocelyn Chu. I work at JSI, John Snow Incorporated, which is a public health research and consulting organization that's headquartered in Boston. So on behalf of Bostonians, welcome to those who are new in town and visiting. The presentation that I'm going to give is a study that I was part of when I was at a research institute in Cambridge, also here in the local area. I've since moved on and joined another organization, but I just wanted to acknowledge that this work was done while I was at the Institute for Community Health, and it was done in partnership with colleagues at the Asian Task Force Against Domestic Violence, which is also here in Boston, as well as Tufts Medical Center. And I think we had to present our disclosures that I have no relationships to disclose. Just briefly, I wanted to walk you through what the presentation is about. First of all, to give a little bit of background into intimate partner violence or domestic violence in the Asian Pacific Islander community, and talk about the questions that we had and the process that we embarked on to explore more about this issue of empowerment within the domestic violence survivors. And then I'll discuss a little bit about our findings, its implications for practice, as well as do a little bit of reflection on what it was thinking about doing research, and especially community-based research in immigrant communities. And perhaps not everybody is familiar, but would have a general sense of the prevalence of domestic violence, or IPV, intimate partner violence, in the Asian Pacific Islander community. It is definitely underreported. It's a very silent issue, but nevertheless pervasive in many of the sub-communities in the U.S. And back in the first sort of representative national survey was done in the mid-90s, the National Violence Against Women Survey, which found that it was 15% of women and 3% of men reported any kind of lifetime experience of violence. Obviously, and these were found to be lower rates compared to other ethnic minorities. While it was a representative sample, it was a national telephone survey. It was only done in English and Spanish, and that is a limitation considering that most of the API communities are about 70% have primary languages other than English. And it was also a very small sample that were contacted, about 1,500. So with these limitations of sort of these national surveys, a lot of research has relied on non-probability samples, things that are surveys that are done out in the community. One that was done locally back in 2000 found that around between 25 and 38% of respondents, and so the question was framed, do you know someone who has was in an abusive relationship? So it wasn't necessarily pointed at that the person being the victim, but do you know of someone? And you can see that these percentages are much higher. Obviously, these were sort of small community-based surveys, so there's limitations there. But also rife in the literature is the fact that immigrant status is definitely a well-known correlate of intimate violence, intimate partner violence in Asian women. And a lot of, you know, in terms of service delivery, the model that is often used is this empowerment model, that it's about the assumption being that, you know, once someone goes through, receives services, that they are going to be self-sufficient or empowered in some way. But however, so there are some recent writings and literature, especially Asian American scholars have talked about how, you know, to step back and think, there are actually that some mainstream DV programs could actually have disempowering consequences. And I think that to put it in the context of this presentation thinking about a migration and a transnational perspective, there is this back and forth that communication and travel between countries now is so much easier. And what people bring here, the cultural expectations and the beliefs, is going to be diffused in service delivery. So it's important to think about how violence actually is defined in API communities. What is acceptable within marriage in other cultures, and how to bridge that understanding and advocate for protection without actually jeopardizing the safety of the victim or the survivor. So, as a group of researchers and community-based service staff, these were the questions that we came up with. That how do we measure if our clients are empowered? How do we know that they are? How do clients and their advocates, and what we mean by advocates are the staff that serve them, how do they define it? Is there any difference? How is the empowerment process actually understood by women who speak different languages or from different cultures and have different life experiences? And what are some of these barriers and facilitators of the empowerment process as defined by women in the Asian American community? What we embarked on was a community-based participatory, bit of a mouthful, CBPR approach, which really guided the whole process. And if you're new to CBPR, it's really a partnership between researchers and community members and stakeholders, that everybody is involved in the research process from the beginning to the end. And so my colleagues and I became that research team. There are a couple of us who represented sort of the academic partners. We had staff from the organization, the agency, as well as a past client joined the research team. And she really added a lot of insight into the whole experience of being a survivor. And together, we developed our focus group questions, or our guides. We conducted the focus groups together in three different languages, and we analyzed the data together. And so I just wanted to quickly give you a sense of who these people were. The focus groups that was conducted in English was with the staff advocates. And then we conducted focus groups in Mandarin with Chinese clients, and then in Hindi with South Asian clients. And you can kind of see that these were relatively young women. In terms of advocates, there was a range definitely of who had been at the agency, a range from very new people to ones that are pretty seasoned. And you can also, I just put also the immigration status of the clients, most of whom had more of a PR status as opposed to being citizens. You know, we had a couple of undocumented. So when we asked, and this whole process of asking how women of different cultures actually would define empowerment was a challenge in itself, and I will talk about that more at the end of my presentation. But what you can see is that there are definitely different interpretations of what people thought about as empowerment. And you can see, you know, just to sum it up, in the Chinese focus groups really focused on it's a right, or it's a freedom. There's, you know, one would have freedom to choose, and I would have, you know, I can determine right from wrong. Similarly, and not so, from the South Asian group, the women were talking about having this new sense of identity, that they were no longer see themselves as a victim, and they talked about being one's own person. The advocates themselves had a slightly different take on what empowerment meant to them. They talked about the ability to actually set small goals and achieve them, and then also having confidence that you're in making choices. And they talked about making choices as a, you know, turning up at a legal appointment or turning up at a mental health appointment. That was really, interestingly, not necessarily in the realm of the clients when they talked about empowerment. Very quickly, in terms of barriers and facilitators, and sometimes you can sort of see that facilitators are, you know, sort of the flip of the barriers, but they don't often match that way. The facilitators of empowerment were just having people who you felt like that they were also on that same journey. Other facilitators were, you know, access to English classes because they felt like that led to economic independence. If I am able to speak English, then I can go and get a job by myself, you know, for myself and earn my own keep, as well as some of these sort of more systems level facilitators having access to services and resources like public housing and immigration services. Interestingly, and probably not a surprise to any of you, was that the barriers were around societal and cultural norms, the way that, you know, the stigma of separation and divorce and being separated from one's husband, having to save face, or carrying that sort of that social stigma, not knowing English and how to communicate in a new country, as well as the fact that the legal system, and that was brought up a lot, just lacked that cultural competency to understand sort of women who had issues with in the immigration system. So just very briefly those. And I wanted to dwell on something that was an unanticipated finding, which kind of emerged with when we were talking to the focus group clients, was this notion of giving back. And they just talked about the fact that when I provide support to my peers who are on that same journey, I feel empowered. Or when I'm able to be a voice and advocate for others, I feel, you know, that's how in some ways an indicator of empowerment. So when we presented the data and findings back to our client, to the participants, we actually did a little bit of brainstorming and said, what do you mean by giving back? What are some ways that clients can give back? And they talked about, you know, if there were any sort of fundraisers that they wouldn't mind giving testimonials. To offer being a volunteer at the shelter, and then again just doing this sort of volunteering and advocacy work for the organization. So having opportunities to give back is both is empowering, as well as you can see that it's an indicator of empowerment itself. In terms of practice, you know, what can we bring back to the agency that they could actually integrate into their practices? We actually found that there were some differences in the way that clients and advocates described empowerment. And so what we would recommend is that there would be some common definitions and goals at the outset of this client-advocate relationship, asking questions about what do you see as success, what are some steps, whose role is it to, you know, how do I, and as an advocate, facilitate your success, but how do I not get in the way of it? We also saw that empowerment is an iterative process, and that while an advocate can be very supportive, when you sort of have to interact with the system, you can actually experience a lot of setbacks. In terms of this study, it was very small. We had a very small sample, we had a very small budget, and so these are sort of the limitations. This is an exploration, and one of the first that we've found that really tried to ask both, you know, not only clients, but the people that serve them. You know, how do you see empowerment, and what is it? I think that the strengths is that it used a participatory approach, which means that the staff at the agency had buy-in, and the results would quickly then translate back to practice as well. I know I'm almost out of time, but this whole idea of transnational perspectives, I think that it's a really important one to think about as there's this flow of people, you know, migration, and yet what people, immigrants here, there's a lot of, you can access culture and resources in the sending country or in your home country. So there's no longer this notion of immigrant, I immigrate and I stay and I have no access to what happens at home. So anyway, I think that in terms of that perspective, the identity as an immigrant woman, a woman and a survivor plays an important role in this whole discovery or exploration of the empowerment process. As one of the, and I had two quotes, one of the South Asian client talked about being a woman is also, what she's learning is that it's also, you know, that woman is also a human being, that I should respect myself, that there should be in India as well, and that women have, as women have no power here. Again, this, and then the Chinese clients, one of them talking about having to rely on my husband, give him the opportunity to control my life. If I have the ability to move to a new country or city and have an income, then I won't. That won't be the case. So, kind of interesting reflections. I think that in terms of what we learned, the lessons learned were that it was really difficult to translate the word empowerment. First and foremost, this concept actually not necessarily exist in Eastern cultures, where it's much more of a collective identity. And we really ran into some difficulties about how to explore it without putting words into people's mouths. So perhaps a better way to ask those questions was, you know, how do you envision sort of success at the end of your receiving programs or something like that. In terms of empowerment, we see that, you know, and I think I didn't mean to say indicators of empowerment, but facilitators of empowerment are at the individual level, at the peer level, but also it's nested in the system. And so when the system is disempowering, it does set back the individual. We went through a lot of issues with the IRB process and consenting process because we needed institutional review, but the institutional review board was at an academic medical center that was not necessarily friendly to community-based research. The consent was about 5 pages long, and this had to be, and they insisted that it had to be translated and then back translated. So a lot of our resources were just pulled into all these administrative issues. And so I think I'm still sort of trying to figure out how do we do culturally competent and you know, community-based research that is friendly to people who speak, who are literate in other languages other than English. So that's just worth discussion perhaps later if you have any feedback. My colleagues and co-authors at the different agencies, the clients and advocates who participated, and then we also received seed money from Tufts. So those are the, just wanted to acknowledge that.